Ladies and gentlemen, as always, welcome to another On the Time Lash. This is our 45th episode. I'm Ben. Mark, congratulations. 45 episodes. And it's our penultimate David Tennant installment.
I think that more than it being 45 episodes is the one that's given me a bit of an emotional reaction. I'm like, oh, God.
Yeah, I have to say I agree with that because I watched the so what we're going to be talking about is the Waters of Mars, dear listeners, and we're going to be pairing that up with and you listeners, yeah, you decided we're pairing this up with the Seeds of Death. We did a little Facebook poll and a Twitter poll, and it was Seeds of Death that that you wanted to see discussed along with the Waters of Mars. But I don't know. I do feel like, to paraphrase, I don't want him to go. I know we've, in real terms, we've already had two doctors and many years after that, but in this revisit, I'm feeling all the same emotions in the lead up to his regeneration as I did when I first watched him.
Yeah, I mean, obviously last episode there was a, I mean, not against Tennant, but I was kind of just like, oh, this is a tired production, it's just, I'm a bit fed up now, it'd be quite nice to have a change. About 10 minutes in the Waters of Mars, I'm like, oh, man, I missed this.
Yeah. The Waters of Mars is fucking fantastic.
I mean, to be honest, I can't think of an episode over the next... Well, no, actually, no, I can't think of one where we are going to be sniffy for a wee while just yet.
Yeah. Although one thing I'd like to discuss in this episode, maybe that should be the core, is I don't remember feeling this way about it when it first came out. Like, I watched it back, and I think it's one of the very best that the series has given us. Why didn't I think that when it first came out? I've got a few thoughts, but we'll park those for a minute. Because it's stats time. Waters of Mars by Russell T. Davis and Phil Ford, directed by the frankly amazing, I think this is better than anything he did in Caves of Androzani, Graham Harper. And it was broadcast originally on the 15th of November 2009 between 7 and 8 p.m. And it was watched by 9.94 million people. Which is pretty decent. Stats. Sorry, that was the stats. First 5 decades poll. Mark, where do you think the Waters of Mars
It's not better than Caves of Androzani. I'm pretty sure of that in terms of the poll.
No, spoiler alert, Caves of Androzani is number 4.
I've forgotten that by the time we get to it. although I would probably have a pretty good stab at it. So I'm thinking it's probably quite high, Waters of Mars. I think it's quite well regarded. Slight technical problems aside, but we'll come to those, I'm sure. The shiny robot,
is it?
And not just the shiny robot, but no, we'll get to that. We're getting ahead of ourselves. Number 45.
Two away, off. Waters of Mars is 43.
Okay, alright.
It's between 42, The Pandorica Opens and The Big Bang, and 44, Midnight.
That is some good company.
Well, let's talk about it. I loved it, so I absolutely loved it. I texted you this. I think I'll just start this as my introduction. I genuinely think that it has within it one of the best lines that the Doctor has ever given, which is when Adelaide Brooks says to him, what's your name, rank and intention? He goes, the Doctor, fun. I think that was excellent. That's up there with Tom Baker's what's the point of being an adult if you can't be childish every now and again? You know, like that kind of... I don't know why it's not on T-shirts and cups, that phrase. I think it's got one of the greatest scenes in all of Doctor Who. I think when Adelaide Brooke and the Doctor are... basically when Adelaide's beginning to suspect that he knows more than he's letting on, and she starts confiding in him about the Dalek visiting her as a child.
Yes, of course,
That whole scene ending with, why are you telling me all this, Doctor? And he says, a consolation. That start to finish, I think, is one of the best scenes in all of Doctor Who. And I think the last half an hour is probably the greatest, one of the greatest half an hours of all of Doctor Who. I don't know what changed in me watching this now from a couple of years ago that I, for the first time, because I never really rated the Waters of Mars, and I don't know why that was, because watching it again was superb.
I mean, I don't remember. It's kind of that weird period where, like, it was the only Doctor Who you had for, like, a few months. So yeah. It was automatically exciting.
Yeah.
And I do remember enjoying it, and I do remember kind of going, oh, yeah, this is interesting. But I don't remember kind of coming away from it going, classic.
Yeah. I wonder if that's maybe something to do with my hopes were not raised, because I don't think I think my opinion of the Planet of the Dead has been fairly standard from then and now. So I don't think I was, after seeing Planet of the Dead, all that looking forward to another special, because I thought it would be of a similar standard.
Yeah, sure.
And I think I also thought that because we knew he was going at Christmas, what we would essentially get is one episode of something that would lead in to the two final episodes. It would be a cliffhanger,
yeah.
Which... Episodes like that always infuriate me, because you get everything and nothing all at the same time.
I still kind of feel like that, but we'll come to that.
Yeah.
It's my own fan thing rather than my own television viewer thing and understanding how television for a general audience works. There's a clash there, but yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if maybe just the fact that it was so long from the episode before it, and it was still so long until the episode after it, that I kind of felt I would maybe revisit it. Like, I'll watch it, but I'll not take it seriously until I've seen the rest of the body of work afterwards.
Sure, sure.
Because, you know, essentially, with the main event coming up, maybe kind of going, right, well, this probably isn't going to be worth investing in right now. We'll wait until I've got the DVDs and stuff at Christmas and everything, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But so maybe that's, again, the problem with sort of calling these things specials and stuff like that, and kind of also having an end point in mind, that when you're watching it in context, you don't quite appreciate just how good it is, because you're kind of expecting something else, or I don't know. Whereas when you watch it for this, where we're watching it in sequence and enjoying it again with a slightly more critical eye, then you go, oh, actually, no, God, this is doing so much interesting stuff. How did I miss that? And it's, well, because you're kind of waiting for the big regeneration story, and this is the one before it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I think that possibly it's... I'm saying the last half an hour is great, and it is, but it essentially is one long scene. And I think I possibly thought, oh, this is just all padding. You know, now I can see it for what it is. You know, the Doctor's slow spacewalk away from the exploding base, the protracted dispatching of all the base characters. At the time, I thought, oh, well, this is just... I mean, they're just getting bumped off. This is just padding. They're just trying to pad this out to an hour. Of course, I see it for what it is now, which is, you know, like essentially torture for the Doctor to help him make this choice.
Yeah, definitely.
Which goes against everything that he has striven to be before that point.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, maybe I was just feeling particularly cynical about Doctor Who back in 2009. I don't know, I can't
surely
remember.
Not.
Before we move on, I feel we should tell listeners, if it sounds a bit different, it's because Mark and I are not actually in the same room for this recording.
No, we're not.
We're doing this over Skype. I want to say it's because of my schedule being so busy, but in reality, I'm lazing about. I'm just having my lunch and a cup of tea. But Mark is... you're a busy man these days, aren't you?
I've got about three jobs at the moment, and that's going to go back down to two in a minute, and I've got, like, a presentation to put... I've got a lot on, put it that way.
Yeah.
So much like the inhabitants of Bowie Base 1, we're kind of communicating... via messages and computer screens. I just hope solar flares don't come out and cut out the rest of the podcast.
So we're doing this in separate rooms. I think this works for the odd occasion, but I prefer You know, I prefer when we're face to face.
I prefer to see your face too, Ben.
Yeah, and I prefer when it's not a cup of tea that I have, and it's.
It's probably wise, to be fair, Ben, to have a cup of tea while talking about the waters of Mars. Because what's the best way to get rid of bacteria in water is the boiling of the water. So.
And also, it's far too early in the day to get pissed.
Yeah, it's a bit. Well, no. I spent 4 days of the weekend getting pissed, so I'm quite happily enjoying a glass of Iron Brew just now.
Yeah, bank holidays, they're not great for the waistline, to be honest.
Or the catching up that you have to do with like all your other stuff once the bank holiday is over.
Yeah. Okay, but back to Doctor Who, back to the waters of Mars. Well, where do you want to start? So that's, you know. I want to apologise to the waters of Mars for my earlier self-critical reaction. This is great. Where do you want to start having a look at it?
Well, firstly, I mean, just following on from our discussion about Planet of the Dead, I think the opening where the Doctor, where the TARDIS lands. The Doctor steps out of the spacesuit and he's looking out at Mars. That is about 100% more convincing than anything they shot in Dubai.
Okay, yeah, I get that. I mean, that is a good point. The other side of that is that opening is one of only three problems that I have with the Waters of Mars. As a pre-title sequence.
Oh, no, right, okay,
It's awful.
It is awful. The cliffhanger is awful.
Well, yeah, I mean, so a shitty, shaky robot holds a gun to the Doctor.
It's just like, it'll be fine.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, the robot is the second thing that I have a problem with in this production. But that opening sequence, it doesn't really bear any resemblance to the sort of episodes that you're going to get.
No, I mean, all you really...
Like, it's really, really wrong-footing.
It is, yeah. I mean, I suppose the only sort of real hint you have is Adelaide's conversation with her daughter at the start.
Yeah.
And then it cuts the TARDIS turning up, and then there's the wonky robot pointing the gun, which you just fling it off the cliff. Just, fine, be done with it.
I mean, the robot slightly takes the sheen off the ending.
Oh, God, I know.
Which is, like, I completely love the idea that the Doctor has sent some sort of robot to automatically pilot the TARDIS for him.
Yeah.
I just don't believe for a moment that even with the wizardry of the sonic screwdriver, that robot is hanging together whilst it just...
Yeah, tears across Mars.
Yeah, because you see it tearing, you see the CGI of it tearing across the surface of Mars towards the TARDIS. But then when it stops to get the key out and open the door, it's shaking and falling apart and vibrating when it moves. And you just think, that thing would not hang together in those circumstances. It's just so... Couldn't they have made it more sturdy? I mean,
yeah, I don't know. I mean, is it the shittiest robot in Doctor Who?
I don't know. But it certainly reminded me of that robot in the Suntaran experiment. Oh, yeah.
Yes, it does a bit. Yeah, that kind of thing with the wires. Yeah,
and you never. I mean, and the saving grace with that is that you never actually got to see the lower half of it. It was always hidden by, it was on a track behind some rocks, so you only ever saw it effortlessly gliding around. Like, there was no problem with that. I mean, it just looks so flimsy, and you don't from... Is this maybe genuinely the first time in New Who that there is an effect which is as ropey as some of the ropiest moments of the classic show?
I remember having a discussion, it was like sort of in 2005, with a friend of ours, Paul, and he was saying, you know what I love about the new series is that the effects are shonky, but they're shonky in a 21st century way. So, you know, like, it's still not quite up to the standard of, like, your American shows, but, you know, like, but it's still on a par with what you have now. I think you're right. I think this is the first time that the new series of Doctor Who has a prop that could easily have featured in the classic series, and for all the wrong reasons.
So that slightly takes the gleam and the believability.
It's not just that though. It's the oh my god, the scene where they're escaping from the floods, the Doctor in Adelaide, and they've got the Doctor does the, you know, with the sonic, and it sort of speeds it up, and you keep cutting back to the orgasming teenager in the other area of the base.
Oh yeah, I don't know why is that affecting him?
No, it's just horrible to watch. It's the one scene in this whole, quite frankly, fantastic production that I wince at. I'm just like, this is it's so it's just really cheap and tacky and poorly acted and oh my god.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, well, I would say that Roman is not great, but actually he's got a great scene towards the end.
Yes, he does. He does.
When the single droplet of water drops into his eye. Mm-hmm. And he goes, look, I, you have to leave without me. I can't go with you.
Yeah.
It's odd that we start out with a show that looks like it's going to be just a classic mid-season romp. You know, like the Doctor shows up, he's doing his Cockney white boy thing to excess. And you meet all of these kind of just fairly generic international crew members.
Yeah.
And then about the 25-minute mark, it completely shifts into a different gear.
Yeah, I mean, you do get the sense that something bad is going to happen, but I think there's still also the sense that, he'll save everybody and it'll all be fine, rather than he'll save everybody, but that's the wrong thing to do, and it's quite tragic and quite horrible. And
It is tragic. I mean, it's brutal. I mean, this is something I think that when people decided we should pair Waters of Mars with the Seeds of Death, is that both of them are brutal.
Yeah.
There are ridiculous body counts and such brutality in the way people are dispatched.
The Doctor, you know, the Doctor kind of starts off. Well, I mean, obviously we're skipping ahead in both of these stories. As kind of, you know, how we expect him, you know, Tennant's the cockney white boy, Troughton's the kind of bumbling, funny professor. But at the end, they're both very stern and in control, and quite dark, actually, in their actions. So I think actually we've ended up with two stories that are quite good to talk about together. So thank you, listeners.
Yeah.
That was...
Because
that was the wild card, because you and I had kind of talked about the other two, which was Earthshock and the Moonbase. And I kind of threw out Seeds of Death just at random, and then I went, I'll stick it in the poll, see what happens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, another good point about Seeds of Death is that from trying to decipher a timing for when that story would be set, I think it's set something like maybe 30, 40 years after Waters of Mars.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah. Well, but more on that when we get to the Seeds of Death. Do we want to get it out of the way first? Do we want to get the darker aspect?
Why not? I mean, it's
rather
the big,
than kind of go through the episode.
It's the big thrust of the second half of the episode is the Doctor's kind of ascension, descension, however you look at it, into the Time Lord Victorious. Which I think is such a great concept, and this is where my kind of slight sort of fanboy disappointment, rather than my person who understands how television works, you know, understanding comes in, is that I kind of wish they'd kept that into the start, and that was kind of how we lead into the Time Lords coming back, and it's just like, you can't keep doing, you know, we have that kind of War Games style thing, where they come back to kind of, because I think there was at this point, this is so close, because this was in November, wasn't it?
So like, yes, 19th
it's
of November.
It's a month before the first part of the sort of regeneration story. And I think by that point, there was a sense that we kind of thought the Time Lords were coming back. If you were reading various message boards and all this kind of thing. So I had read that and be like, oh God, this is such an interesting way to reintroduce that idea. You know, you have that scene where he's walking away and he hears them dying, which is great. It's so well done. I mean, arguably, he could have just turned off the microphone, and the Tenth Doctor really loves to punish himself. he really loves to torture himself. But as he's walking away, and he's kind of flashing back to that kind of discussion about how he's, you know, he's had various times throughout the series that he's the last of the Time Lords, that there's rules in place, and in the olden days, people would, you know, enforce those rules, but now those people are dead, and it's just him, so he can do whatever the hell he likes. I was like, oh, God, this is so interesting. This must surely be leading to the finale. And then it kind of just wraps itself up in the end.
Yeah, it really isn't mentioned again. No. In the end of time.
There's just, we'll find out when we watch it, but I think there's the conversation with Wilf where he goes, oh, I did some bad things. It's like, oh, okay. Because also there's the period between, again, we'll talk about this, I suppose, but there's the period between this and the end of the time where he just seems to just bugger off and just have loads of fun again.
Well, that's where the Day of the Doctor isn't it? Yeah. And he seems to be, for the most part, behaving himself.
Yeah. Apart from accidentally getting married to Queen Elizabeth. Aspect, I was a little bit disappointed. But what we have is, I would say, David Tennant's sort of proper swan song. It's the last chance he gets to do something really, really interesting with the character.
He just seems to look different. I don't know what it is, but there seems to be when he becomes
There's something in his eyes, I think. There's that. It goes right into that. And I mean, and I think the hair is kind of at its most manic as well, while he's kind of doing that kind of thing. And he's a man possessed by his own power, by his own, you know. It's an incredible performance.
But the thing is, I mean, I just love that. And this is where both the performance and the writing are great. It's because of the nuance, which is, the Doctor is ultimately abusing his power, but for good. And as a viewer, I mean, so as a you know, for the character, it's an interesting story arc. But for a viewer as well, like, I don't immediately take against what the Doctor is doing. In fact, I support it and think, yes, it's a real punch the air moment when he starts materialising the TARDIS around the survivors. And it really, Adelaide Brooke isn't just talking to the Doctor, she's talking to the audience as well, saying, this is why there are rules in this series, this is why he doesn't do that. One of the things that Russell T. Davis said is that there are loads of stories when he was showrunner of scripts coming across his desk where the ending of it, how they got out of situations, was that they in some way managed to remote control the TARDIS. And he was like, nah, that never happens, the Doctor doesn't. The show doesn't cheat like that. But the fact it's used in this is a kind of illustrator of the Doctor's standards breaking down. And that he is manipulative in this way. And we cheer it and we think, yes, the Doctor now can do anything. This is great. Because, you know, he might get away from himself and talk about little people, but I don't think what we're watching here is like the making of another Master or the Rani or the Time Meddler or something like that.
I mean, I suppose it's the idea that he is doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
But where's your end point with that? When does it stop? And I think that's kind of why I wanted to kind of continue with it, because it's just like, oh my God, this is so interesting.
So it is great that Adelaide is basically talking to us, going, no, that's why this can't happen. And that, crucially, is why in this series of specials where there is no companions, there absolutely has to be a companion.
Yeah, as and I think no companions is a really interesting point as well as to why this happens, is because it's so much evoking. There's the obvious dialogue about Pompey, but actually, just in terms of how things are shot, and in terms of the fact that we've just lost Donna. I mean, obviously, it's in terms of how these episodes are spaced out, it's been like over a year. But in terms of the actual episode count, it's not been that long. And you know, she's the one that convinces him to save Caecilius's family, and she's not there anymore. But also at the same time, she was the person that said, you know, you need somebody to stop you.
Yeah.
And it's just this brilliant sort of culmination of all this stuff that's like, it would be really lovely to have Donna back, because she would kind of rein you in a bit. And I suppose that, again, leads us quite nicely into this kind of final two-parter.
I mean, it's obviously that he cares, and it's obviously this kind of Time Lord Victorious is born out of trying to love and write the universe.
Yeah.
But the companion is essential, because it physically is something that he can get a perspective on and visualise as that that want that he has for the universe. So the ending is the only thing that maybe slightly mars the ending is that I still don't understand why Ood Sigma is there or shows up. Why are they Ood his? And even knowing what comes after this, I still am no clearer.
Don't really understand.
That's why he's got an Ood spirit guide or whatnot, you know.
Yeah, because there's the bit where, like, at the start of the end of time, where he's like, oh, I was summoned. And it's like, okay, is that what that was? Because that just looked like an Ood standing, going, you right, mate?
Yeah. Yeah, but then he's also summoned for... For what? We'll talk about this, I suppose, when we get into the next episode. But it seems like, if anything, the Ood are summoning him out of the way, so the Master can start the plot.
Yeah.
You know,
yes, perhaps,
in which case, then they're working for the Master. They went, right, we'll summon the Doctor.
Well, you know, they do like to work for evil intelligence. So.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, we'll keep him talking on the Ood sphere while you become reborn in a prison,
yes,
and then eat some tramps. And
spoiler alert: eating some tramps is totally next episode title.
Yeah.
Actually, just the last thing I want to say, just about the kind of. The Time Lord Victorious climax, I suppose, is the word you'd use, is that it makes so much more sense in this, in a similar sort of runtime, than, you know, what happens in The Girl Who Died. You know what I mean? Like, because I think we discussed this when we talked about the episode, that you don't quite buy into the fact that he would go to such lengths to save one person. Whereas this, you really get the sense of it. Everything's played so well. It's like, it's all the setup at the start with the Doctor's Wikipedia brain, which is a bit of a weird thing. And then, you know, him hearing everybody dying and how, you know, he's the Doctor, he saves people. And it's just so much more intelligently thought through and sort of brought to, like, a great sort of conclusion. And it's something that they tried to do, like, all the way through Series 9, and it doesn't quite come off, this, you know, the consequences of those actions and all that kind of thing. And that doesn't quite marry up as well as it does here.
Why is that? I think you've got a great performance from Lindsay Duncan in this.
Yeah.
And they really took great pains to make it... Basically, what we've got here... is another historical, you know. In the background reading, what they wanted to have with Adelaide Brooke is that she should be thought of in the same way as Agatha Christie and Charles Dickens and William Shakespeare. She was a historical character, but she was from the future. The Doctor knew about her. She was from our future, but it was the same sort of thing. It was meeting someone who was incredibly important to history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've got a really great performance by Lindsay Duncan. It's really strong, it's nuanced, it's harsh, but also emotional. And I think, plus also the fact where it's a single episode on its own. It's a big high-stakes special. Mm-hmm. Whereas The Girl Who Died, you're right, was in the middle of the season. I don't think we really got to know Maisie Williams, his character, Ashielder, until... after she'd been brought back to life.
Yeah.
So I don't think we thought she... This is a horrible thing to say. Deserved it as much. Deserved being brought back to life.
Oh, was she too much of a little person, Ben? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that was...
You need to be stopped, my friend.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go upstairs. I'm not going to go upstairs and shoot myself, though, just to prove my point.
Okay, maybe not. You got work to do. Deserved. Maybe that's the wrong way of saying it. But I don't think we'd been quite as comprehensively introduced to Ashielder, made to love and feel for her and her situation as much as Adelaide Brooke. Because, as I said, one of the best scenes in all of Doctor Who was really getting to know her, finding out as a kid that she'd stared eye to eye stock with a Dalek. From that experience, she'd learned to love and explore rather than hate and take revenge.
that is an incredible scene, and actually it kind of leads me into one of the other things I kind of wanted to talk about with this story. So obviously it was a tribute to Barry Letts, who had died that year. And yeah. I think The Waters of Mars is just such a really lovely sort of harking back to the classic series and to the recent history. And mm-hmm. and it's not done on the nose. It's just all these like really lovely subtle touches that are there to pick up on. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the Dalek scene is quite an overt reference to Journey's End, The Stolen Earth.
Yeah.
And it's played so beautifully, and it's so nice to actually to basically play in that world that you've created, and to take this character and have her kind of origin story. I hate that term, but it's the best yeah. one. It is based in that. It's like you say, seeing the Dalek and deciding to chase it and to see the universe. That's so great. And the fact it's the exact opposite of what the Daleks come to represent, well, what they represent, is so great as well. But then you've got other just little touches, like I say already, you know, the links back to Fires of Pompeii. You've got just the Ice Warriors spoken of in this kind of mythological sense, just to kind of add a bit of backstory to the flood and to the planet, I think is also really great. Enough to just for, you know, people that have never seen the Ice Warriors, because we haven't at this point in the new series, to be like, oh, that sounds interesting. But then also there's just that little added, like nice warm feeling that you get when you get a classic series reference in Doctor Who. And it's all just done so brilliantly that it never derails, you know, the story. It's great.
Yeah. I mean, having just come out of the 20th anniversary of Doctor Who, the TV movie.
Yes, sure.
Obviously, one of the main contentious issues about the TV movie is how much, not kisses to the... Well, they called it kisses to the past, but it was like full-on snogs to the past. You know, it was to some degree getting fingered behind a skip to the past. with some of the references in the TV movie. You're right. It's completely right when these little elements show up in The Waters of Mars, and they're completely earned, and they're completely beautifully decorative.
Anyway, sorry, you were saying beautifully decorative, yeah?
Beautifully decorative little kisses to the past. Concluding, of course, with Barry Letts's little dedication at the end of the episode, you know.
Definitely, and I think, you know, it's almost as perfect a tribute to Barry Letts as you could find. You know, he's him and Terence Dix are people who really kind of saved Doctor Who. You know, in many ways, kind of allowed us to still have Doctor Who now because of the way they kind of turned that show about and made it so popular. Because obviously, people talk about Tom Baker and that. And that's fine, that's very true.
Yeah.
But there was that great turnaround, and Pertwee was so loved in that role. I mean, he played the character for 5 years, and it's all down to that kind of template that Barry Letts and Terence Dix set out. I mean, we wouldn't be watching Waters of Mars, I don't think, without what they did to the show.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to start saying some people are more important than the others.
No, obviously.
I would say that, you know, if you're looking at three complete guiding lights within classic Doctor Who. Verity Lambert, of course,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and John Nathan Turner, definitely. But Barry Letts is one of those three, three big defining characters that created Doctor Who.
Yeah,
you know.
That's why he comes back in the early 80s as an executive producer, you know, to kind of to shepherd that kind of transition.
Exactly. And I mean, also, he was a director and a writer as well.
And an actor.
Which is... actually within Doctor Who.
Right,
so
he's got...
There's more of his creative DNA in the series than a lot of other people's, you know.
Yeah. And actually, another sort of classic series writer that I think I was thinking of a lot while watching this time was Robert Holmes. And I think we've probably said this before in the podcast that Russell T, a lot like Robert Holmes, is so great at that kind of building a whole world and a whole universe in just like a couple of lines of dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, the way that the characters on this base are so effortlessly sketched, very small lines, I mean, also, you know, terrific actors,
mm-hmm.
but just with a couple of lines of dialogue, we exactly get, like, you know, Alan Ruskell, famous Doctor Who monster guy, whom for the first time we get to see as a, you know, well, he's again a monster, but we get to see what he looks like. I mean, it's heartbreaking, him happily munching on a carrot, one of the first carrots on Mars, and then seconds later he becomes this drooling, crack faced beast. It's you know, it's just, you know, a little bit of dialogue about loving carrots, and you really feel for that guy's transformation, you know.
Yeah.
It's well done. I mean, we should also say Phil Ford has got as much to do.
Absolutely. He's I mean, this is his one and only TV script for Doctor Who, isn't it?
No, he wrote Into the Dalek, didn't he?
Oh, is shit, so Ford? He did. No, sorry, yes, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, he did.
Yes. Whether we class this as canon or not, is, do you remember that kind of CGI animated Dreamland?
Yes, he wrote
Doctor
that.
Who.
And he wrote the games he wrote as that. Well. The adventure games, or whatever they were called.
You know, and he's peripherally involved. I mean, he was a producer on Sarah Jane Adventures. He wrote a couple of Torchwoods, stuff like that.
And he was on Wizard. I mean, he's one of those kind of, I think, as Gareth Roberts was before he started writing for the series in series 3?
Yeah.
He's kind of one of those people that was, like, really involved in the sort of, like you say, in the periphery of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So sort of writing these games, working on Sarah Jane. And then he went on to work on Wizards vs. Aliens as well. I think he was the showrunner for that. So it's really great to see him, you know, get an on-screen credit. And a story as brilliant as this one.
Yeah. It would have been nice to see more. I mean, why do you think he hasn't been involved in writing for the show more than he has? Do you know? I mean, I've no answer to this because I really I should have checked IMDb or something like that beforehand, see what he's actually doing. Maybe it's just been a timing issue, because
probably
he has been asked back, you know. But
yeah, because I mean, like, say Into the Dark, which I'd completely forgotten about.
But you would have thought this episode was announcing his creative partnership with the series.
I guess it's that kind of problem you get when, I mean, firstly, obviously he was also working on the Torchwood, Sarah Jane.
Sure.
But also, you know, you have a new production team coming in that have, I guess, I mean, granted, Gatiss and Roberts, you know, write for that. But also you've got other writers like Steve Thompson started writing from series 6, wasn't it?
Did he now? Yes, I think so.
But anyway, I mean, you know, like, you've got a production team that have their own writers involved. And I suppose also series 5 is probably being written at the time that this was also in production. So it's kind of that as well. I think you're right. I think it's just timing. And other commitments and all that kind of thing. I don't think there's anything particularly unseemly or sinister going on. Listen to us, the Doctor Who podcast. It's just like, no, there's nothing unseemly or sinister going on. Rather than trying to find gossip and you know, distrust in around every corner.
Yeah, I mean, it's just because we've talked about this often, about what, particularly when we get into series 8 and 9, mm-hmm. and Stephen Moffat, there would be a lot more writing co-credits. And, you know, in doing background for reading for this, you really appreciate how much Russell T. Davis certainly did, but how much equally Phil Ford did for this episode as well.
Has said, it was in the Toby Haydock podcast, that the reason he has a co-writer credit on this was that he was like, well, you know, I rewrite all these scripts anyway. Like, if we're going out, I kind of want to take a bit more of the credit, like, on these last four stories.
Well, yeah, so another reason, apparently, is that he was urged to take a credit by, because Wars of Mars very nearly didn't happen due to financing. And Julie Gardner said that because there wasn't going to be the usual series budget applied to these specials, they each had to have their own money sourced to create them. And one of the things that would ensure that money would come in for these episodes was having Russell's name, so that it would be seen to be a big, prominent episode and not just a kind of smaller, fobbed away to another writer, unimportant mid-season episode, as could sometimes be, you know, the idea taken in television.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
And another kind of side issue with this as well is that it didn't nearly happen because so apparently a lot of the money from this was going to be sourced to pay for it, was going to be sourced from BBC and to entertain BBC Worldwide's interests in Woolworths.
Oh, God.
And then Woolworths crashed.
Yeah.
It closed down. There was the 2009 crash and money dried up, and it looked like maybe there wasn't going to be the Waters of Mars because there was no money coming in from Woolworths to make this episode. And then they sourced the money from elsewhere.
Uh-huh.
But it's just really interesting that, of course, he would have had, as a producer, a role in creating the story, but his name had to be on there because it ensured investment. Much more than if it was just Phil Ford writing the
episode.
That's
really interesting, actually. Yeah, I'd never really thought about that.
Yeah, I don't know if you managed to get hold of a copy of the writer's tale, because it genuinely, I think I was a bit kind of, is this really an essential Doctor Who read? I think it genuinely is. It tells you a lot about the stuff going on.
Oh no, it is. The original copy that I've got, I had just such an enjoyable time reading that, I've been meaning to get the one just about the specials.
So it's the final chapter,
yeah.
Yes, it's got all that kind of stuff. There's just so many juicy nuggets, and you see in this period how constantly in flux everything was, because this went out in November. Originally they wanted to have this was going to be the Christmas episode, and then it was moved back so that it would be they wanted it to be the Friday or the week before Christmas, so there would be essentially three episodes of Doctor
Who.
And they thought, well, no, because that maybe kind of takes away from the focus that we're going to put onto the two regeneration, the two par. So we'll move this to maybe do like a Halloween thing. But then, I think the final of X Factor was supposed to be on Halloween.
Oh,
so they went, no, we can't put it on there. So you know, so this I think of all the specials had the most intriguing and turbulent of birthing periods.
Well.
There endeth the lesson. I don't know if that was interesting or boring.
I was interested. I hope you at home were interested as well.
Yeah, I just love the larger issue that the Waters of Mars may not have happened because Woolworths went into liquidation.
See, I mean, you will pay the price for not, you know, having a specified target market, you know? That's just, you can't just sell a bit of everything, you know, the people will go to specialist shops for that. Are we seriously doing Woolworths material in 2016?
I genuinely find it fascinating that a sizable portion of the BBC's budget came from selling DVDs through Woolworths.
Yeah.
I think
Woolworths were... But I think they part own To Entertain. I think it was something to do with that.
I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure...
I think you are right. Do with that. Rather than, oh no, we've lost a bunch of stores to sell our DVDs, which obviously they also did. And would continue to do as Virgin and HMV kind of followed suit.
Yeah, okay. It's such a weird concept to get your head around. We can't have a special of Doctor Who, why? Because Woolworths are shut.
Ben, that's why we don't do the Bloomberg podcasts, and, we don't understand finance.
We don't understand.
Just...
No. No, I'm looking at my bank statements this afternoon, and
yeah.
I think it proves I don't understand finance.
You and me both, mate. You and me both.
Well, okay, performances. 100% it's David Tennant. But, what I want to talk about is, I think I said it at the start, this is Graham Harper, one of his very best works.
Yeah, sure.
I think the horror elements of this are, you know, there's this idea that you, Doctor Who, and you watch it from behind the sofa, and really, really, how often does that actually apply?
Yeah.
Here, genuinely, I think you've got very definite frightening, not just monsters, but monster transformation scenes.
Yeah, it's...
Like that very first, when Alan Ruscoe's eating the carrot, and he, you know, he begins the transformation. It's shot with him in the background, slightly out of focus. And you just mm-hmm. see, like, this... Like, you don't see the face, you don't see the actual transformation.
You see the back of the head.
The back of the head, and, like, there's just body convulsing and shaking, and then coming to rest. All the while someone else is in the foreground talking away about, I can't remember exactly what, their family or something.
Yeah.
The transformation scenes are great. Like, that scene, when the Doctor and Adelaide come across that Alan Ruscoe's character... pouring water over the head of the knelt
yeah.
other Flood character. That is great. Just the way it's shot, the lighting, the distance of you know the framing, and I don't know. You're more technical than I am about the language of film, cinema and television.
No, I mean, you were using all the right words, just not necessarily in the right
order. Or to any degree of meaning. But yeah, I just think it's the horror elements are beautifully and tastefully shot to create exactly yeah. the right feel, which is a genuine sense of threat, considering it's just people with water coming out of their mouths. This could have been so ridiculous.
But it's not. That is what's so great. You know, I love the idea of sort of water as a villain. You know, because the human body is, you know, made of however much percent water.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got something that turns that against you. That's such a great Doctor Who idea. It's kind of amazing it's never been done before. But yeah. I think, if I remember right, the reason for that was that they were trying to kind of figure out a way to do sort of living water for a while, and then I think this was like an idea that he'd, and obviously CGI, you couldn't quite pull that off, and then obviously they come up with this idea of like hoses in the arms, and it's like, well, it'll possess a human being, and then, you know, we can have them sort of embodied that way rather than kind of these kind of shifting watery shapes or whatever.
Yeah, they wanted to have something like, you know, the water snake from the film Abyss. It was going to be something like that, and they went, well, this is too expensive. So that, because Woolworth closed...
Bloody Woolworths.
Yeah, the CGI budget had to be taken right down so they could still film this in the HD that they'd started filming Planet of the Dead in.
Of course, yeah. And all because people had, they'd invested too much money in a business model based on pick and mix. I just...
Yeah.
Anybody that listens to us outside of the UK is going to be like, what the fuck? I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah. What would be a comparison in another country? I don't know. Something fun to do, ladies and gentlemen. If you're not from Britain, Google Woolworths. And it was just like this old... It was basically like a giant glorified corner shop.
I guess.
Franchised right across the country in colossal buildings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's how big Woolworths used to be. So there used to be the normal Woolworths that you got on the high street, and then there used to be like big, you know, like out of town shopping parks.
Oh, Big W.
There was the Big W, and my sister went to see Westlife there for a signing. At the height of their popularity, they were the biggest band in Britain and Ireland. The biggest band. I don't know where, mid late 90s. And Woolworths was the place that they hosted this meet and greet in Edinburgh. That's how big it was.
I used to work in the Big W just after I finished high school. And the only thing like that I remember was the fast food. This is getting really. Locally specific now. But the fast food rockers did a similar event and nobody really turned up for that. It was quite depressing to watch.
Fast food rockers. If you don't know who they are, listeners, then we're on the website in the show notes. We're going to put a little link to one of their YouTube videos.
It's just as well Ben's editing this episode, because if I was editing it, you'd know fine well I'd close the episode with the fast food rockers. So think yourselves lucky.
Yeah, I think we want to distance ourselves from that level of tripe. It's right. Anyway, come on, Waters of Mars. That's what we're dealing with here. Anyway, Graham Harper does some great work as the director on this. I think it's beautiful from start to finish, and the horror elements are genuinely that horrific. They're genuinely scary to watch.
Definitely. Has he directed any? I'm so bad at this week. Has he directed any Doctor Who since?
I think this is his last one. I think this is it. He's, yeah. That? I don't think he's done anything with Stephen Moffat.
That's a hell of a story to go out on if it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, well...
Let me check that. And if we're staggeringly wrong, I will cut in from the editing and say, hiya, guys, we were wrong. Or not.
What you should now do is, if we weren't wrong, you should cut in and go, we weren't wrong. Carry on. Enjoy the episode.
I will. Ben cutting in here from the editing. We weren't wrong. Carry on. Enjoy the episode. All right, bringing it in. Favourite performance, I said, was David Tennant. Before I cut in, though, what was yours? What was your favourite performance?
Lindsay Duncan. I mean, David Tennant as well, obviously. But yeah. So that I'm not just repeating you.
Yeah.
Lindsay Duncan is excellent as well.
Everyone's great, I think. In this, I think everybody has
except
their own...
for Gadget.
Gadget. Okay, I mean, I've said many times what my favourite scene was. Are you in agreement, or is there anything else that you want to point out?
I think the Dalek scene is great. I also really like the scene in the airlock, where she won't let the Doctor leave until he tells her what's happening.
Yeah.
I think that's really well played between the two of them, because they're not in the same room. They're, you know, they're just recording their lines to camera. But yeah. It's really powerful.
Although that first monster transformation... I think is great. The whole thing's class from start to finish.
Good stuff, yeah,
it's been really, really great getting to know this again and having my opinion changed and discovering another jewel. I don't know, it's like finding a tenner down the back of a settee or something. That's it's what it's like. All right, well, shall we have a little break and then we will head over to the moon?
From Mars to the moon, much like the Ice Warriors themselves.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the Seeds of Death.
How exciting.
All right, welcome back, guys. That was the Waters of Mars. This is the Seeds of Death. And we'll start with the stats, as per. So, the Seeds of Death... written by Brian Hales. The story is by Brian Hales, and he actually wrote the final drafts of episode 1 and 2. But episodes 3 to 6 are actually by Terence Dix, based on his storylines. And it was directed by Michael Ferguson. I think a classic Who director who hasn't actually done all that many Whos. I think, what else has he done? Like the Ambassadors of Death.
Yeah.
I think one of the Peladon stories, and that's kind of about it.
But great directorial style.
If we're talking about Graham Harper doing some sterling work, Michael Ferguson has done some fucking excellent work in this story. Episodes were broadcast between Saturday the 25th of January 1969 and Saturday the 1st of March, strangely enough, 1969, all of them going out between 5:15 and 5:40, and they had an average of about 6.9 million viewers, which, is... terrible for back then, but brilliant for now.
It's funny how things change, isn't it?
First 5 decades, Paul Mark. Where do you think the Seeds of Death is?
I was saying to you just before we started recording, this is the first time I've seen it since I think it came out on DVD. There's so much in this that really struck me. And actually, you saying the year it was transmitted makes it even more interesting a story, actually. But we can discuss all that in a minute. However, it's not perfect, but nothing is. Let's see, 109.
Okay, 109. Let me... 109? No, it's 126. Between 125, Planet of the Ood, and 127, Frontier in Space.
Again, not bad company.
Not bad company, and yeah, kind of think that's where it lives.
As I said before,
like to you before we started actually recording, there are so many excellent elements to this, but it doesn't seem to create a classic for some reason.
Okay,
I'm not quite sure. But let's pick up on what you said just before you guessed. Let's start talking about. Why do you find the year, the date of this story interesting?
Can you just run the dates by me again?
So it started, it was broadcast from January to March 1969.
Okay, cool. So, what I find absolutely wonderful about this is that, you know, it's airing the year we land on the moon, you know. And it's all about, we stopped at the moon.
Before the actual moon landing happened.
And it's like, well, we just stopped at the moon and we didn't really bother to go any further. That's amazing. That's such an amazing dystopian vision of the future that goes against what I mean, obviously we weren't alive then, but goes against what I imagine that kind of feeling was at the time of, you know, of endless possibilities of, and I find that incredible. I think what's really great about it is that the Seeds of Death acts as, it kind of acts as a warning. It acts as this kind of, you know, yeah, it's all very well to be like looking to the stars and, you know, dreaming about where, you know, what happens after the moon, but you can't just put all your eggs in one basket. You know, you have to kind of preserve the old ways. You have to, you know, think practically about, you know, what happens here on Earth. And actually also watching it now, it's like, well, they were right. We don't have a transmat system or anything like that. But we did kind of stop at the moon. NASA did lose a lot of funding. The American government has sort of focused more on problems on Earth instead of sort of like going out there into scientific exploration. And I was just like, this is utterly fascinating. And also the debate they have about, you know, all rockets are obsolete and all that kind of thing. And the rocket is the thing that saves the day, essentially. Rockets and satellites and old technology, and the message is that don't throw away all your old technologies. And as somebody who's studying film at the moment, that's like a big part of that. It's that, you know, just because everything's gone digital, you don't throw away your old projectors, don't throw away, because digital isn't necessarily going to last forever. There's problems inherent in that, and you might need to go back to it's that kind of legacy preservation. And I find that like really interesting, and to see it in, it's maybe not dealt with in the fullest possible way in this story, but I just think it's so refreshing to see a Doctor Who story that has this kind of really interesting debate that is still relevant today. I think it's,
yeah. I mean, they could have firmed up the logic slightly.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it is spectacularly short-sighted for Earth to be completely reliant.
Yeah, that's one of the problems.
On a TMAT and B, a TMAT station, a single TMAT station on the moon.
Yeah, which is in charge of all of the world's food.
Yes, yeah.
Which is odd, but...
And also, I mean, it would have been nice to have spent a bit of time seeing what the world was like in that period, because people become incredibly hungry very quickly when that TMAT starts going down.
There's no sense of how long it takes the Doctor and Jamie to get... Well, I suppose they say that. I said, well, how are people getting that hungry in that short period of time?
Yeah, but then this nicely marries into to the waters of Mars. Mm-hmm. In that there's a line that Adelaide Brooke says about standing on Mars. It's just, she says something like looking out onto a surface that isn't covered in smoke. And presumably she means the smoke of industry and civilization. So obviously Earth has been incredibly crowded and industrial, and you know. But with that, we should start talking about that. Is that in terms of the dating? This episode. So they never say it on screen, but it's popularly thought that this is set somewhere in the latter part of the 21st century.
Okay.
So it's interesting to think that after we watch The Waters of Mars, which is all about this woman inspiring future of her generations to go out and lead the space race, what seems like pretty much immediately after the end of The Waters of Mars, maybe as a result of the destruction of Bowie Base, there is a real regression, and Earth becomes quite closeted and cut off and insular.
Well, it's the granddaughter, isn't it, that goes off into space. So there's still this period maybe to come.
So it does nicely fit in, and you can kind of think that maybe after this incident, this Transmat rocket incident, the importance of rockets and spaceships is reignited, and one of the motivating factors in that is Adelaide Brooks' granddaughter.
Perhaps, yeah.
Who is supposed to be the little girl right on the video screen right at the very, very beginning, isn't
it?
That's who Brooks talking to, and it's that little girl that we're talking about. So I just think that there is a, without anybody probably doing any checking, without any attempt to marry these two things up together in terms of continuity, it actually fits in
quite
very
nicely,
well.
Yeah.
Is that after Bowie Base, there is a real suspicion of space travel. So there is a reliance on T-Mat.
And also they couldn't grow all those carrots they grew on the moon. They can't send back to Earth, so they've got to rely on the T-Mat to send all their food.
Of course, yeah. They can't trust Mars.
Exactly.
But then obviously in the next 40 years the Ice Warriors move back into Mars.
Yeah,
it seems. So anyway, that's the dating issue. I don't know. So where do we start about it? So I think it's an interesting tell. That I think it's directed really well by Michael Ferguson. I think there's some really great performances in this. I mean, really great performances in this. I think where this kind of is let down is that it becomes really, like, despite all of these other great things, the actual storytelling is pretty plodding.
Sure.
It seems to go on a bit. And I was going to say that maybe this is a feature of Brian Hales's work. Because when you look at all the other stuff that he's written, The Celestial Toymaker, The Smugglers, The Ice Warriors, The Seeds of Death, and you've got the two Peladon stories.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's really going, those are the ones, those are the classics.
They're really zippy, aren't they? The plot really zips along
Those are the ones to save if there's ever if we have to just gather together some Doctor Who. But maybe that's doing Brian Hales a disservice, because having recently revisited The Celestial Toymaker for fun, it's actually astoundingly boring. And I wonder if that, like this, like The Seeds of Death, is down to not the fact that it's down to Brian Hales, but it's down to the fact that Brian Hales has been heavily rewritten. So in The Celestial Toymaker, it was heavily rewritten by Jerry Davis. And then this has been heavily rewritten by Terence Dix. Now, I know it's sacrilege to think that maybe Terence Dix has done less
brilliance.
Yes. Five Doctors cast a long, shitty shadow. But I'm just wondering if there's something about what Brian Hales does is that he should be left up to his own devices rather than being rewritten. And in some way, being rewritten, it's sapped it of any kind of energy or fun or vibrance or anything that was...
Perhaps, but we'll never know. We'll never know, though, will we? Really?
We'll never know. But I think that's where I think that's why Jed, because the performances are great. I think Patrick. I think the regulars are incredible as usual. There's some really great bits in the regulars. I love the fact that Jamie decides to have a fist fight with an ice warrior in episode 5. Yeah. Like, he finds that he's been backed into a corner and he's no other recourse, so he just like puts up his dukes, ready to have a fist fight with an ice warrior. I think that's great. I think there's some really great work from Randy Padbury.
She's brilliant,
as Zoe.
I mean, I love the scene in the rocket at the start of part 3 where she's like, oh, you know, we're gonna what is it, hit the sun or something in 5 months' time, and Jamie's like, oh, we don't need to worry about that because we've only got enough fuel for a couple of hours.
Yeah. And she's also, I mean, the fact that we were missing Patrick Troughton for one of these episodes, it's interesting to see that it is actually Zoe that takes a lead in moving things along, rather than Jamie or any other male base personnel. I think that's great. I think Troughton puts in a great performance,
wonderful.
particularly at the end when, let's face it, he actually kills two ice warriors.
Yes,
this is the first time.
After sending a whole fleet of ships into the sun as well.
Yeah, yeah, nothing. Just destroying them all. Not giving them the option. Giving them a second chance.
It's funny, and I'm sure this destroying. Is something we'll be discussing when we talk about Matt Smith, which is very soon, and I'm kind of excited, but also kind of sad to say goodbye to David Tennant, as we discussed at the start. But there's a lot of criticism of Matt Smith's Doctor that, you know, he's like a bully. He's, you know, he's very sort of cold and calculating, and he's always kind of cited Patrick Troughton as a reference. And, like, he is, like, dead on. I mean, like, in the end of this, you could see Matt Smith doing that sort of bumbling around in the foam and falling over and and then going, I've sent your whole fleet of ships into the sun and now I'm going to gun down the two of you because you tried to take over the Earth and I'm not really very happy with you for that.
Yeah, and then there's the third death, where he spins the Ice Warrior around, so it uses its own gun to shoot the Ice Lord.
It's once again Patrick Trout and the Bruce Willis of Doctors.
Yeah, it's crazy. So you've got the secondary cast as well. There's some great stuff going on, let me get the old cast list. Because they are all really sympathetic characters. Oh. Even what's his name now?
Are you talking about Fuchsin?
Fuchsin, yeah.
He's my favourite performance. I'm putting that out there now because he's the most pathetic human alien collaborator that we've had in Doctor Who. It's so great. It's got so much depth to it. It's just, you know, he doesn't want to die, but he's really conflicted over what he's doing. But if he stops helping them, then he'll die. And he really doesn't want to die. But it's, yeah, and then he has those kind of moments of conscience. And it's an incredible performance over those five episodes that he's in.
And it's nice to see, maybe one of the few times it's ever happened, Commander Radner... Uh-huh. Ronald Lee Hun, a genuinely supportive military official, not someone screaming at the Doctor to be arrested or that he's a spy.
Yeah, I love that bit where the Doctor goes, oh, well, we could help. He goes, oh, Doctor, that's fantastic. You're like, oh, that's a nice change. not that kind of suspicious, what's in it for you? Why are you trying to help us? He's probably a spy. Lock him up. He's a spy.
He's a spy. Let me just explain. You be quiet. That kind of.
Oh, okay. You can help us. That's great. How wonderfully nice of you. Let's work together.
Yeah, and considering that if there was ever a call for that kind of behaviour, it should be now.
When three strangers turn up and offer to fly your rocket to the moon. It's like, aye, all right.
Yeah, they're uncovered in like a bizarre space museum, and like they just we'll help you. Oh, brilliant. Do you want any of your personnel to come with us? No, just you three.
No, we're just going
to... You three
seem fine. We're just going to fuck off in your rocket, mate. We might be doing it for your benefit, but we might just be nicking a rocket.
So maybe he's a bit too trusting, but it is nice to see that there's... Because there is that kind of... this is basically another base under siege Troughton story. And in all of the previous base under siege stories, there is always one of these two-dimensional baddie commander villains... and it's just nice to see... It's genuinely nice to see all the supporting cast working together.
And
they all have very real motivations.
And even Fuchsin, that whole thing where, oh, you know, he'd rather stay on the moon than stand trial. It's still not that kind of... Because Zoe's kind of like...
Now, see, I always thought it was the other way. I thought he knew that this was his chance of redemption.
No, I've always seen it like that. But, I mean, just in terms of the dialogue, like, even then, it's not, like, attacking the character because you've got another character to go, well, you know, maybe not. Maybe there's some other reason. It's great. Yeah. Like, nobody's kind of got that really one-dimensional, oh, you're a traitor or you're a spy or you're trying to... It's lovely. Yeah. Really nice, really good, well-formed characters.
Yeah, but aside from all of that, you know, the great performances and the direction, it just feels like it takes ages to do anything. Like the Doctor doesn't really do anything. in part one and two, he just gets ready to go on a rocket, and then he goes on a rocket. And then part, is it episode three, gets like knocked unconscious, or he's missing for episode four.
Yeah, he gets knocked unconscious at the end of three, and he's missing for four, yeah. Although he kind of, he shows up again, I must have missed a bit, because he gets transmatted away, and then he kind of wakes up in the, at the start of part five.
No, so he doesn't get transmitted away. So it's probably one of the best scenes, isn't it? So the Ice Lord tells Fusham to bundle him into the transmat, and they're going to kill him by beaming him out into space and just dissolving his atoms like that. And Fusham doesn't want to do it. However, he distracts the Ice Warriors whilst Jamie undoes like a hatch at the back of the transmat, pulls him out, and they take him to that little secret room that they've got, and he just sleeps there for half an hour.
I must have been similarly distracted by writing a note about something.
Because they do kind of hide, but then that means there's a whole episode where they're just waiting for him to wake up. And
but, you know, Trevor needed a holiday.
Well, he did. You do often forget that happens, don't you? I know we discuss it a lot, particularly with Hartnell and stuff. I think that's maybe one of the ways that when Troughton is missing from an episode, it's far more noticeable than when Hartnell was missing from an episode, because of the nature of Hartnell's character, because of him being like an older character,
and also
and the fact that they'd always written a stronger character to be the right-hand man. The action is always taken on by somebody else, whereas Troughton, because he very much is the centre of the action, when he's gone, you miss him. There isn't necessarily someone else to directly take over from him, you know.
Which I suppose is good. You do have Jamie and Zoe, but you are right. The Doctor...
They're... Like, they're not, like, Jamie and Zoe are not an Ian or a Steven, say, you know.
I mean, I think it's that kind of, you know, we talk about it a lot, it's the fact it's a six-parter, and is there really enough story in there for six episodes? Probably not. There is a lot of kind of running around in sort of, like, air ducts or whatever. There's that whole, is it the end of part... Is it in part four or is it part three? I think it's part three. Yes. Where the Doctor and Co. are sort of running away from an ice warrior in this like sort of Scooby-Doo, Keaton silent comedy style-y through like halls of mirrors and around corridors. Yeah. And it's really bizarre to watch. I've completely forgotten that happens.
Yeah, so it leads up to that classic scene.
But it seems
scene
to go on forever.
Your leader will be angry if you kill me, I'm a genius. But leading up to it, there is this weird...
Yeah.
Why is there a room full of reflective surfaces?
It's...
in that transmat place. Only there. It's a design that's not taken on in any of the rest of the architecture of the building.
Yes. This is our collection of reflective surfaces. We like to keep this...
I don't know,
nice,
I mean...
clean.
If they're on...
Welcome.
Nah,
have a run around.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, but there is a lot of padding. what's his name? The first two episodes, we've got Christopher Collis Phipps, but he's the guy that takes like 25 minutes to like build a heat device. you know, you physically get to see him assembling an invention to destroy an ice warrior.
Yeah, and then he doesn't even bother to watch the door while he's on the
that's classic padding, is that it just shows somebody assembling.
Doing a thing, yeah. But then the flip side of that is that when stuff starts to happen, because of the nature of the programme and because of the budget, you have to then resort to the computer telling you what's going on around the world. It's, you know, it's that kind of Russell T. Davies era sort of newsreader thing, but what they've at least done with that is that you've got, like, clips and stuff. It's just a voice droning on going, you know, however many dead in Beijing and, you know, and all that kind of thing. And, yeah, it's like there's a lot of, especially in part four, I think, there's a lot of telling rather than showing going on. There's just lots of people telling things to other characters There's lots of people
Doctor Who in that period. I mean, we've talked about this with the invasion. Is that we remember the invasion, and I do. I know I was a bit negative about it when we actually recorded the podcast, but I do love the invasion. But there's an awful lot of it, particularly in the last couple of episodes, where it is just a lot of people on like telephones reporting. Yeah. The Cybermen have invaded Mumbai. 90 million people are dead. But all we can see is the Brigadier, a close-up of the Brigadier standing in a room full of radios.
Looking a bit concerned.
You know, the fact that like the whole last two episodes are about trying to like get some Russian missiles in the air. And it's just people sitting looking at a screen being told that the Russians over the phone have got their cutting to... Couple of stock footages of rockets taking off, stuff like that. You know? You know, it's very like, and the web of fear is very much like that as well. You know, conveniently the Doctor and Cole land after the city needs evacuating and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's like that. But that's why. But I think there's also the because this is obviously Troughton's last season. I think there is a real period here where they were struggling. Ratings were going down, and they were struggling to make ends meet in terms of budgeting. And maybe the sets in this thing look not necessarily as sci-fi technology as they need to look. They kind of seem a little bland sometimes.
Perhaps, which is maybe why you have this reflective surface collection room. But then there's also there's bits and pieces shot on film. So is that because they had to go off to Pinewood or Elstree or something, or is it because? Do you know this?
No, all the film stuff is outside stuff. It's all the Ice Warrior on Hampstead.
Because there's the bit where Jamie and Zoe enter the what's it called, the Weather Control Bureau.
Yeah.
And the entranceway. Is shot on film as well.
Oh, that's because they couldn't rely on the foam working as live if they were recording in a television studio.
Okay.
And also the cleanup operation would mean, you know, they had to do it in an environment that they could easily clean it up and that it wouldn't necessarily affect or break any technology.
So they had to, right, okay.
So they had to do it in but yes, no, I know what you mean. Yeah, no, it was because apparently the only reason it was foam is because the BBC had a foam making machine, and they to make the money back, they kind of pressured television shows to include foam to justify the cost. Apparently.
I mean, the Zed Cars episode where they use the foam machine is a classic, obviously.
I take a look at some of the extras on the DVD. I think Terence Dick says that the seed, which is not a seed at all.
No, it's a balloon.
So it's a balloon and kind of pollen and that kind of thing. That's why it's foam, they kind of were duty bound to help the accountants and use the foam machine. But that's another thing about where this episode is great, is that there is a lot of stuff that is integral to the plot which happens on film. So they've obviously had a bit more time to spend on it, and it looks great. So all these crucial moments of the story are incredibly well represented. The foam never looks like just shitty foam.
Yeah.
It's very creatively shot. And I mean, the whole bits leading up to that, a backlit ice warrior walking through an evocative forest.
Michael Ferguson being a brilliant director.
Let's talk about this, because there are a lot of great scenes. So all of that kind of stuff. I love the bit where the Ice Lord is talking to Fushum about the invasionary force that's arriving, and it's like a tight shot of the two of them facing each other, and it's backlit by the computer screens on the back wall.
I think what's good about that shot you're talking about is that he's filming the Ice Lord as if it is a living, breathing thing.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the time in Doctor Who, it's just a monster, we won't bother, you know, we'll do a long shot or something like that.
Like when Daleks talk to each other.
But it's so much more believable if you shoot it like you would shoot another actor. You know, yeah. you would bring the camera in close for this sort of dialogue scene between two people.
Yeah, and the whole reason that the character, so we're calling it an Ice Lord, which is kind of the fan name that's been created for it. Is it Slar? I think is the character.
Yes, yeah.
The whole reason that sort of Ice Warrior was created is because they wanted a more human-looking, more able communicator for that race. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think that scene would be as effective if they'd, say, got back Bernard Breslau to be just a normal-looking Ice Warrior for that scene, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I love the Doctor's sort of, oh, you know, I always find travelling by T-Mac very disappointing as well. Like,
yeah.
Because you're just there. There's no kind of enjoyment. There's no...
Yeah. Well, there's no big budget production like the Beamen are out on Star Trek or... Yeah. Like, you remember the effect of the Keller machine disappearing and reappearing in The Mind of Evil?
Yes.
It's where they just completely do, like, wavy lines over the screen. and you don't buy into it. But this, you do. It's just, it's so... You can understand slightly why T-Mat has been taken so for granted by humanity, because it just... They effectively convey how simplistic it is.
Yeah, it's there, you know, you're one place, you're another place, that's that.
Yeah.
It leads to that kind of, that sort of insular society that seems to have kind of come out of that, and that's why, you know, you don't look towards the stars anymore, because, we're happy here, just travelling amongst countries, you know, instantaneously. Like the internet.
Uh-oh. Satire before it even knew it was. Yeah, I'm enjoying talking about it more than I think than I was when I was watching it. I don't mean that in an insulting way, though obviously I do. But it's one of these stories where the ideas in it and the performances and the things to mull and think about afterwards are so much more rewarding than I think necessarily the way they're portrayed in the actual episode.
I'd agree with that. Yeah, I think that's a fair summation. Because there is a lot of really interesting themes in there that we've already discussed, and also like the time in which this was aired, I think, is really interesting. It's just kind of a shame that it's within these sort of this sort of slightly flabby six-part story where there's a lot of running around. There's a lot of
100%. It should have just been a four-parter.
Yeah. A really tightly packed sort of four-part story with those same themes, you know, I think it would be a lot more sort of highly regarded.
I think going back to the very concept of what this podcast is about, you said it in episode one, this is like an Amazon recommend. Mm-hmm. If there are listeners who haven't seen the Seeds of Death, how would you appraise it, Mark? Do you think people should go and seek this out?
Yeah, I do. I think there's still enough in it. It's, you know, maybe visually it's a bit dated, but in terms of its themes, I think it's still quite relevant today in terms of kind of how it deals and sort of visions of space travel and sort of, and also kind of how we sort of throw away technology and things become, you know, redundant or outdated, and, you know, is that right? You know, should we be sort of holding on to these things? I think there is some interesting stuff in there. I think in terms of just really, really great Doctor Who performances, you know, it's Patrick Troughton, Fraser Hines and Wendy Padbury are just superb throughout. So it's a great example of that trio. And also, you know, there's just a great supporting cast. So I think there's enough in it to kind of, you know, show everything that is really good about Doctor Who.
Yeah. Especially since, obviously our last episode was Planet of Fire. We say this all the time, but it just is so... It's so good to go back to a classic story where there's obviously chemistry between the actors, but the regulars, the regular the Doctor and companions, they like spending time with each other.
Yeah.
It's not combative. There's no arguments. There's
as you do with your friends. You know, that's the whole point, isn't it? It's that they should always be friends with each other. That's nice.
Yeah. Here's another thought. Can I ask, how did you actually watch The Seeds of Death? Did you, firstly, what was the version that you watched? And secondly, did you watch it in one go? Did you watch it episode by episode over a couple of days?
Okay, that's an interesting question. So basically, my Doctor Who collection is still in Edinburgh due to various situations. Basically, the situation is that I can get it delivered to my house, but I'm very rarely in my house at the time delivery people turn up, so it's quite awkward. So hopefully I'll get that back next week. So what I did was I watched it on Dailymotion,
okay,
which was a fucking nightmare because the amount of adverts that would come on every 5 minutes. So I eventually sort of put an ad blocker on and it was fine. I could watch it uninterrupted. So I did sort of two episodes a day for the past 3 days.
Okay. Okay. Cause...
which was quite a nice way to do it, actually. It was kind of... yeah, it was good.
Yeah, because, I mean, taking this as a whole story, as we always do with all these discussions, it kind of removes it from the original context, which was it was something that you would watch over 6 weeks. It was episodic television. Sure. I wonder if, should we start talking about, when we come to, like, best performances and best scenes, what our favourite individual episode of a serial is, you know, like what do you think in somebody like, I, you know, like when it was first broadcast and the audience was sitting down, what do you think was the best individual installment? What was the most rewarding seeing that episode in and of itself? Should we talk about that sometimes when we?
Yes. Well, should we do that? Should we do that when we do Matt Smith's era? And the classic stories would do that, because then it'll be like a new...
okay, sure, yeah. Okay.
It'll be a new format for a new format. Okay. How about that? That sounds good. Does that sound okay?
That sounds great. That sounds good.
All right.
It sounds like we're going to be keeping this a secret then, like, try and guess Ben and Mark's favourite individual episode of The Seeds of Death, and you could win, I don't know, something.
The Jar of Sweet. Wait, what?
We'll have that. But yeah, I just think that maybe watching it...
no, it's a nice idea, actually, yeah.
You know, because maybe the kind of fatigue that I felt watching this story, maybe it was brought about by the fact that I did watch it in a one-hour over the course of a day. You know, not in one individual sitting, but I watched it over the course of a day.
I think that is a good point. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, obviously there are Doctor Who stories that stand up absolutely brilliantly as, you know, like watching it as an hour and a half in one go. But yeah, maybe it is better to kind of focus on individual episodes. In fact, actually, I remember the early days of me going to the Edinburgh Doctor Who group. They did a thing where, like, each Monday somebody would choose their favourite episodes, not their favourite stories, but their favourite episodes of Doctor Who.
Sure.
And I always find that quite an interesting thing. So yeah, so why not? Why not do that?
Yeah. I don't know. I just thought to close this down, I just was going to single out episode 3.
Episode 3 is a good one. Yeah.
As my favorite, because I think it's got a great cliffhanger, which is the right the end. I mean, it's before it's the way of writing Troughton out for his holiday, but just the end where the seed pod explodes and he falls down incapacitated and you think he's dead. I think is there's just a lot of good stuff I think that happened. I mean, that is also the strange runaround in the mirror room. That happens.
Which is
that
fine. It's quite fun to watch, but it just doesn't add anything.
Yeah. I think it's maybe just the fact that it's the first episode where the plot seems to be starting to move along. Because the first two episodes have been very much about setting out the stall, you know.
Yeah, true. I mean, I've only written down my favourite scenes.
Well, should we bring it in and start doing... What are your favourite scenes?
So, I mean, I think anything really with the Ice Warrior outside is brilliant.
Yeah.
It evokes, to me anyway, this is maybe like, I'm maybe stretching the point somewhat, but it kind of evokes James Whale's Frankenstein for me a little bit. Just that kind of soul, sort of stocky figure, kind of moving, sort of lumbering through the countryside.
Is that the original, is like the 1930s?
The original 30s Frankenstein. I just think it's really beautifully shot, and I think there's just like a nice kind of tension to everything. I like that a lot, actually. I think this Troughton series, with obviously the Web of Fear the year previous, is it a year? Well, 2 years previous. This is where that idea of the monsters in contemporary Earth settings really comes in, this is where they go, oh, actually, it's quite exciting to put monsters into recognisable locations.
Yeah.
Rather than on a studio set. And it's here. It begins with you know, the Seeds of Death, with the invasion, with the Web of Fear. Yeah. So, yeah, so I really like that a lot. I think that's
So just a side issue of that. So in the script, I think the parkland that the Ice Warrior walks over, I think is supposed to be Hyde Park. Either in the actual script or certainly in Brian Hills's storyline, his scene breakdown, it's Hyde Park. Now, obviously, it was shot in Hampstead Heath.
Yeah.
I went up to Hampstead Heath the other day just because it's a nice place to walk around. And I didn't go looking for it, but I went on the trusty Doctor Who fans web resource, Doctor Who Locations, Locations Guide. And somebody, and all power to this guy, hats off, has actually painstakingly found the exact location.
I thought you were going to say that he'd started a Doctor Who foam party on Hampstead Heath.
I'd attend that as an old school Doctor Who convention. But he's like painstakingly gone out. And do you remember the scene where there's a guy reporting back what the Ice Warrior is up to, and he's framed so that he's shot between the two main branches of a tree, and the Ice Warrior guns him down.
Uh-huh.
The guy's actually gone out and found that exact tree.
Wow.
So this guy has roamed all over the quite sizable area of Hampstead Heath to find that exact tree. I just think there's... It's just like Doctor Who. We always knew Doctor Who fandom was about minutia, but like, that is above and beyond
the call. That is incredible. Hang on, though, right?
Yeah.
Does it have, like, a map... Like... sort of map reference for you to find the tree?
Yes, I think so it's got a little map in the right hand corner so you yourself can now go and find that tree.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it is. Doctor Who fandom is brilliant. I don't know, I agree with you. There's loads of scenes that I like. I think my favourite one, which is that's the one I'll say, is the weird dark second Doctor we get right at the very end.
Yeah, that's good. That is good.
I like that a lot. And I think I like the scene right at the very beginning where they're in the TARDIS trying to identify where they've landed.
Yeah, I like that. What I like about the first episode is the scene of the Doctor being like properly hurt that people laugh at all the old these old rockets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's great. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's just such a really lovely performance.
You know, then it's his own fault. He shouldn't have been party to blowing up Bowie Base in his own future. So that's... yeah, performances. That's not a bad performance. I think you're right. I think it's... is it Terry Scully?
Terry Scully, yeah. I like Terry Scully very much.
It's Fushum.
Interesting note about John Whitty, who is the voice of the computer in the Seeds of Death. So, I mean, there's a lot said in Doctor Who about typecasting. You know, I left because I didn't want to be typecast. Or like Carol Ann Ford left because, you know, she didn't want to be typecast as the screaming teenager. John Whitty has played computers in a number of other productions since The Seeds of Death. I don't know if that's what got him the role, but he was the voice of a computer in Out of the Unknown.
Okay.
And also in an episode of Some Mothers Do Have Him.
Wow, okay.
I think it's the Job Centre or the Employment Centre or something episode. But yeah, so there you go. A man marking out a career as the voice of a computer.
Well, fair enough. He did other
things. He has done other things, you know. Okay. But still, I just found that quite funny.
I think that's us done Seeds of Death, eh? Is it?
Yeah, I think so. It's been quite a fun episode, hasn't it? Hasn't it, listeners?
Yeah. I mean, again, I think I do prefer, and I'm sure the listeners will agree, when we're face-to-face. But, you know, if we're now both... You know, we seemed to get more done when we lived in two different cities, a country away, than we do when we're now in the same city again together. We're still doing it over Skype.
Yeah. It's, you know, timing. Sorry. Hopefully we'll get back to some form of... hopefully it'll be fine.
Yeah, I mean, it might be an idea if we take a little break, not for long, but take a little break after the end of David Tennant era, just to think about how we're doing this and do a proper relaunch like they did with the 11th Hour.
Indeed. Where we change absolutely everything, including ourselves, Nolan.
But yeah, okay, so that was the Seeds of Death. That was the Waters of Mars. This has been, I've enjoyed it. It's been really rewarding. I got to find out a whole brilliant new episode of Doctor Who that I had seen but previously had not considered. And the Seeds of Death, there's so much interesting subtext and nuance to it. It's great.
Definitely. Yeah.
Now, obviously, the next episode is going to be a bumper edition because it is the end of time,
the
part
end
one and
of
two.
Time.
All right, well, thank you for joining us, listeners. As always, if you want to get in contact, there is Facebook, Twitter, and email, which is on thetimelash@outlook.com. Mm-hmm. Find our website. You can see all of our past 44 episodes plus little specials here and there archived. It's on thetimelash.wordpress.com. Mm-hmm. And we'll. We'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
In two weeks' time for the end of time itself. thanks from us. Goodbye.